Hi, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you most want to write also happens to be what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their wonderful yearly writers' conference, the best in the Northwest, of course, you can go to pnwa.org. See, if you are a PNWA member, starting in January, I'm going to be continuing my memoir writing class. I think I'll be doing one a month, January, February, March, so you can sign up for that. I think that'll be available very soon for your signing upage. And also tonight at East West Books, this is December 10th, so tonight at East West Books, I will be teaching part two of my Writing as a Spiritual Practice class, and then tonight we're going to focus on Law of Attraction and listening in the writing experience. And next week I will be teaching part three, where we're going to talk about time and the present moment in writing. So you can sign up at eastwestbooks.com, or you can go to williamknauer.com to find out about those things. And of course, if you're ever looking for some bedside reading to soothe your writer's heart, pick up a copy of Within Yourself, An Author's Companion. Get your daily dose of writer's inspiration. It's Right Within Yourself, An Author's Companion. So, you know, every writer, well, every human being, but every writer has an ego. In fact, we have to deal with our egos, I think, quite regularly, whether we're at home alone writing or submitting our work or getting reviews on Amazon or the New York Times. So every writer's got one, and I'm sure today's guest, the fabulous suspense writer Mike Lawson, has got an ego too. It's just that in all the years I've known him, I've just never seen it. I met him, I think, probably was just about when I started this magazine, 2007, so he'd released his third in his Joe DiMarco series. I think he had just released House Rules. And what a nice guy. You would never know meeting him that he had, at that point, I would never have guessed that he had three hardcover books out with a major publisher, but he did. And at this point now, he's got, well, I think it's seven currently, and then an eighth, a brand new direction he's going to be taking, coming out the end of this month. And so I am just thrilled to have him on the show, talk about all that's going on in his life and his writing life. Mike, welcome to the show.
Well, Bill, thank you for having me. I appreciate you doing that, and the classes you're teaching sound very interesting. That's compelling stuff.
Well, it is to me.
I guess, regarding my ego, I guess I put in that I've actually published eight DiMarco books, and a ninth will be coming out this July, and then this new book will come out this December.
Oh, House Odds is your eighth, right. No, I miscounted. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, so House Odds is the latest Joe DiMarco novel, and Rosarito Beach by M.A. Lawson will be out on December 31st. Wow. So before we get to those two books, because your first book was Inside Ring, and that was published in 2004 or 2005, was it?
Yeah, 2005.
Okay. Before we get to that, writing is really your second career, isn't it? Your second career that you've had in your life.
Yes, it is. Very lucky. I worked for the Navy as a senior manager for the Navy for about 30-some years, and just coincidentally, although I'd started writing quite a bit before then, I got my first book deal the year I retired from the Navy job. So it was just very
really?
Good lucky timing is what that was.
All right, so you're working in the Navy, and, you know, I assume you're putting in your 40 to 50 hours at least, right? Full-time job. at that time.
Yeah, that was the kind of job. It was actually more than 40 or 50 hours usually. But I had one thing going for me that that most writers, I don't think, had this advantage, and that was that I took a ferry back and forth, you know, from Seattle to Bremerton. My main job was in Bremerton.
Yeah.
And I had in the morning I'd be doing Navy work on the way over to the shipyard, but in the afternoon I'd have 35 to 40 minutes to myself. And I think very few people have the luxury when they have a full-time job of having, 40 isolated minutes where you just sit there and write. And I've told a lot of people, all it takes is, half an hour a day, and at the end of the year you'll have, 300 pages of total crap, but you'll have written your first book. And so
that's
I was just
true.
Very fortunate in my case. I actually, in looking back on it, I had that ferry ride.
So you, and so at, towards, so I assume then towards the end of your Navy career, you started opening up your laptop and working to and from the job. Is that right?
Yeah, it actually was about, it took me a while to find my, to find an agent actually. So it was about 10 years before I actually, I was out there for 10 years, writing a couple of novels, actually about three of them, and trying to shop them around and get an agent to be interested in what I was doing. And then, like I said, it was almost lucky I didn't get a contract while I was still working. I don't know how I would have done both, but so I was out. It took me a long time to find the right agent and get published, and then from there I've been very lucky after that.
All right, so we interviewed Mike years, probably 2009 or so, when we had just started up the magazine, and so some of you may have heard the story, but it Mike has one of the more interesting agent stories as to how he got that first real agent, because you did have one before him, I know, that although that didn't really last very long. So would you mind telling that story of how you got is he still your agent, by the way?
Yeah, he still is my agent, and he's probably the only reason I'm still getting published.
In
this recent TV deal, I guess, probably all, it was also thanks to him. But, doing there for about 10 years is I was this was not exactly before the days of Internet, but I was out there sending query letters out to agents, and then during the course of that 10 years or so, I actually had three or four agents that didn't work out. And one of my favorite pre-agent stories was I'd been rejected by agents on both coasts, multiple times. And there's some lady out in Ohio that she said she'd never sold a book before, and I figured at that point, what the heck, since I didn't have an agent. And so she represented me for a little while, and then one day she called me up and said, geez, I'm sorry, but my computer broke and my basement flooded, and I just can't handle the pressure of two clients. And so I was the client that she dropped. And time went on, and then about the time I retired from the Navy job, I was sending out query letters in batches of 20. I would just send them out, and half the time I didn't even know who I was sending them to. It was just another name on a list. And one day I get a call from a guy, which is very unusual. Agents usually send you a form reject letter. But this guy called me, which was odd, and I really didn't know who he was. I didn't remember I sent him the letter. And he said, hey, I kind of like the sample chapters you sent me. How about sending me the manuscript? And I said, yeah, sure. And I mailed off the manuscript, and then a couple of days later, the guy calls me back and says, I haven't finished reading this thing, but it's pretty good. He said, would you mind making a few changes? And I said, yeah, I guess. And he tells me what he wanted changed, and I got off the phone. I said, who the hell is this guy? Well, I looked him up, and I found out it was John Grisham's agent. And at that point, I'd have been willing to change my name from Mike to Mary, frankly. And so it was just very, like I said, I didn't even realize who he was when I sent him the letter. So right. It was just like a lot of my life, just very good dumb luck.
Well, I love that story. I'm sure. And I love that story because, I feel like in the publishing world, it's maybe changing now somewhat with all this e-publishing and all that. But there is a sense like certain people, maybe it can, sometimes a writer can feel as if certain people are kind of beyond their reach. But I think it's important for writers to remember that all those agents and editors, even the big name agents and the big editors of the big houses, need books for their industry to exist. And they're also looking for the next big thing. They want to find that next. They'd like to find the next John Grisham. or the next.
Well, the way I actually found this guy was along the lines that you're saying. I used to look for lists of agents on, you know, in books and on the internet and things
right,
like that.
Right.
But one other thing I used to do was I would go down to bookstores and I'd flip through books in my genre. And I'd look for, you know, every new author in the acknowledgement section will acknowledge his agent. And so
sure.
I'd find a debut novel by some author and I'd copy down. That's how I actually found this agent. I copied down the name of this agent. But because my thinking was, well, if they'll represent one new guy, you know, maybe it's only one a year. Maybe they'll represent another new guy. And
yeah.
and that was the logic behind sending off the letter. And then, like, it's like you said, every year they discover, you know, somebody new.
Well, they want to discover somebody new because that's part of the fun for them. I mean, it's nice when an established writer, they have the established writer and they can sort of just feed along their career. But for them, it's exciting to find that new author because they're in it for the discovery, just like, you know, you're in it to discover the story that you're writing. I think that
yeah,
the agents and editors I've talked to. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's very true. Like my agent, you can tell he's just enthused about what he does. You know, he's enthusiastic
yeah.
about the, you know, the books that he reads and the clients and things like that. And you can sense that when you're talking to him.
Oh, but that's so good. I had an agent once who I liked the guy, but he's so depressed. he was so fatal. He was actually had a pretty good career. He'd been at it forever. He's at a big agency. But he was just so depressed all the time. And I'm like, look, I really don't need any help getting depressed. I can do that all on my own. I need an agent who's excited about the possibilities, you know. And it sounds like you've got that, so that's great.
Yeah, mine is very much like that. I mean, not only is he fun to be with socially, but in terms of I'd tell you, he's also very optimistic. You know, he'll read something, he'll say, gosh, I really like this. You know, and sometimes I get the sense he's more optimistic than I am. And I kind of need that. And so that's good.
Optimism is key because the future is unwritten, Mike. And so we might as well be hopeful about it because it's just a story either way. If you're fatalistic, that's just a story too. All right. So you published your first novel. That was in 2005. You published Inside Ring. Must have been very exciting. But now you have to write the next one. Was it challenging for you to get back on the wheel as a published author, or were you just geared up and so excited to have a contract that you didn't care?
Well, for me, the writing, I imagine it's this way for most writers. I don't know if compulsion is the right word or not, but I love to write. I mean, I get up every day and I write. I write every day.
Seven days.
Yeah, I do. I mean, sometimes, you know, it's two or three hours, and sometimes it's 4 or 5 hours. I usually start about 5 in the morning, and I'm done before noon. But for me, I never had anything I didn't need for something to spur me on. You know, it seems like there's always another story idea, and the writing is fun. And usually when I'm writing more than one book at a time, because if I've got the luxury of time, I like to put one book down and work on the other one for a while and come back to it. So I've never had a problem, you know, having to, you know, wake up in the morning to figure out what I'm going to write or trying to search for the desire to write. I enjoy what I'm doing. It's not an agony for me. It's fun.
All right, so do this for me. Let's say Mike was a character in a novel, and Mike is a writer, and he loves to write. But now we need to paint for our readers why he loves to write, just like you would maybe try and describe why a detective loves to solve crimes, why a skier loves to ski. What is it about writing that brings Mike pleasure? What is it about that experience?
Like I said, for me, I just did an interview with the San Diego Tribune, I guess it was, and the guy asked a question on this last book. He said, "Is there some big issue behind this you were trying to push, you know, an agenda of some kind?" And the answer is no. What I usually find is I'll find a story idea that interests me, and then, you know, I hate to use a word like fun because it sounds so trivial, but for me, it's fun to develop the story. It's really fun to make up the characters. And so I find myself getting caught up into, you know, the story I'm trying to. I'm a guy that doesn't outline. And so I'm
right.
sort of a discovery for me as I'm going along, trying to figure out where I'm going with the character and with the story. But the process is enjoyable. I mean, it's probably enjoyable to anybody in whatever you know, when you're telling your friends a story, you're making up a story, you know, it's usually a process that you get some enjoyment out of. And like I said, I've seen writers that talk about the agony they go through, and I don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah, you know, Jeff Ayers, who's a friend of yours and one of the associate editors for the magazine, so he does audio interviews, and he just did one with a fellow, Greeney, I think his last name is pronounced Greaney, who was the co-writer, if that's even the right word, with the last three Tom Clancy novels.
I know Mark. I've been out to dinner with him a couple of times.
Okay.
In fact, he and I have been nominated for the same award a couple of times. Very nice guy.
All right.
Hardworking guy.
Yeah, he seemed real nice. And like I said, he worked with Clancy on his last books. And in the interview, he talked about how I'm paraphrasing it now, but the story kind of goes that he was, of course, a huge Clancy fan. Now he's hired to go. So he goes and meets him somewhere in D.C. And he talks about, and he tells Clancy how much he loves to write. And Clancy kind of rolls his eye and says, "Oh, yeah, well, you're new to this. You'll get sick of it. Writing's boring," he said. I was sick of it a long time ago. And I thought, well, then he must have lost track of why, of the discovery, lost track of why it was fun. Because I know so many writers like yourself who have written 10, 12, 15, 20 books, and it is not boring to them. Not even close to boring.
I met Elmer Leonard a couple of years ago down in at the Tucson Book Festival. Now, here the guy is, you know, he's 84, 83 years old, whatever he was at the time. And you could tell the guy has as much enjoyment out of what he's doing today as he probably did when he first started. I mean, you can think of a lot of novelists that have lasted into their 70s and 80s, you know, and they wouldn't do it. I mean, a guy like Leonard, he obviously wasn't doing it for the money. I mean, he's doing it because he enjoys doing it.
Right. Now, interestingly, but one of the ways to keep it interesting, I think, and perhaps one of the reasons it didn't stay interesting for Clancy is he didn't allow it to change in some way. I think you've got to go to each project. I mean, for instance, I write a daily column for Author, and so I've done one a day for 4 or 5 years now, so I've written over 1,000 of these things, and it's always about writing and life, but I go in and try and find something new to say every single day, and that keeps it interesting, which is part of the reason Rosarito Beach exists, because although you love writing a series, there are stories that can't be told within that series, right?
Well, that's exactly right. But the thing about Rosarito Beach is I've tried before. I mean, I've had story ideas that didn't fit within the story. And in one case, my publisher, Grove, for the DeMarco books, I gave him a book, and it wasn't a DeMarco book. And they came back and said, "No, we want another DeMarco book." And it just so happened this was a book I could turn into a DeMarco book. And I did that. But the way Rosarito Beach came around is again, it wasn't that I was looking for something. It was a television producer happens to like the Emma character in my DeMarco novels, a very strong female character. And he called me up one day and says, "You know, we got to work on a made-for-TV movie kind of thing with a strong female protagonist." And I thought about all that, and I scratched my head, and I kind of scratched out a screenplay, and I talked to the guy, and he said, "Well, you don't understand. All our stuff is set in Ontario. And this story that I came up with was set down in San Diego in Mexico." But then I decided, what the heck, I kind of like the story, and so I turned it into a novel. And then I gave it to Grove, and they said, "No, we want another DeMarco book," which I happened to have one ready, and so I sold them that one, and we ended up selling Rosarito Beach to Penguin. But it wasn't like there was some big master plan here. It was just it just started off with an interesting idea that I, ended up rolling up into a novel, and I enjoyed the novel. And like most writers, once I've got something written, I want it to go somewhere. And I've been very lucky again with my agent and with a very good editor at Penguin Blue Rider Press, a guy named David Rosenthal, and he liked the book and was enthusiastic about it, and so. Again, probably just dumb luck, but it was fun to write.
I'll tell you, if it's fun for the writer, it's much more likely to be fun for the reader. I think if you can amuse yourself, you have some. Because if you're not amused by it, I mean, you can have self doubt, but ultimately you have to be interested in. Oh, look at this. We have a caller, Mike. I think he has a question for us. Let's see what he has to say. Is this Jeffrey?
It is, Bill. How are you today, my friend?
I'm just fabulous. How are you doing out there in frosty New England?
Watching our first flakes fly by the window.
Oh, boy, it's coming. Oh, winter is coming. Do you have a question for Mr. Lawson?
Yes, I do. And snow is the other foul four-letter word for me. Wrong place being anyway. Mike, I'm such a fan. Your work is wonderful. My question is, other than having a very strong feminine side, I can assume, how do you write your female protagonist so well? Literally like it's written from the mind of a woman, to be a bit blunt about it. How is it an acquired skill set? How does one acquire that sense of craft?
You know, that's an interesting question.
Good question.
And I'll have to admit, I never did anything, you know, in particular to try to write from the perspective of a female. I was just, well, in all my books, I tend to switch perspectives from one character to another. And when I'm writing, you know, the Emma character in DeMarco, I mean, I've got in my mind, you know, what the character is like in terms of her background and her personality. And then I just write it, I guess, the way I would expect that she would think. Now, in Rosarito Beach, it was harder, not because of the protagonist. The protagonist is a very, straightforward, doesn't play by the rules, doesn't play well with others type of character. And I can't tell you too much about it without giving away the plot, but there's one character in the book who's a 15-year-old girl. That was really hard for me to write because I don't have a 15-year-old daughter. And I ended up spending about an hour on the phone with a friend of mine, and the daughter, the 15-year-old book and this girl actually, you know, gave her the same name as my friend's daughter, and her personality's a lot like that. But that for me was hard, was the teenage perspective, which I'm at my age out of touch with, was tough for me. But writing an adult female character, I guess, you know, like a lot of writers, I've never found that to be. I don't think that hard. Now, how well I've done it, I guess it's for the reader to judge. But
you kind of find it within yourself.
Pardon me?
I was going to say, you kind of, man or woman, black or white or whatever, you find that person sort of exists within you in some way or another, I think. That's how it always felt to me.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think it... probably all the characters sort of exist within me, but I found, like in my DeMarco books, you know, DeMarco's probably more me. You know, it's just the way he would view life and his perspective on life. It was probably pretty much my perspective. But like the character in Rosarito Beach and the Emma character, my DeMarco's law, but, you know, their perspective is not mine. But like I said, you develop within your own head a view of this person, what their, you know, their objectives, their thought processes, their abilities. And I guess you just go from there. But I don't sit there and go into a different, you know, an alternate mode when I'm writing, you know, the female part.
Yeah. Yeah, but how often you're a pretty intuitive writer. How often do they surprise you and take the book in a direction you never predicted?
Well, I guess the way I would say that is, I tried to explain this to people because, like I said, I'm not an outliner. And what I find happens, and it sounds kind of weird, but the character helps me write the story. You know, as I develop the character, particularly the bad guys, I'm always trying to explain, you know, in the story themselves as bad guys.
Right.
And so I find myself once I've got the character, you know, and what he tends to do next is you know, is based on his character, and so that does in fact help develop the story as you go. And that's why outlining doesn't work for me very well. I almost have to get in the whole mode of dialogue and everything else to, you know, to go to the next step in the book.
Right, to find out who they are. And I think that, absolutely, and I think that, you know, a story, you can do it this way, but I don't know how you can really have a story that isn't based on who the characters are. I don't know how you can not have the character, because the story's about things, what happens to people, and who they are and what they want and what they don't want is going to determine what happens. So they have to, who they are has, in the best circumstances, has to move what we call the plot, because, or else they're just sort of like pawns that the writer is pushing around a chessboard. And that, and whether you're writing literary fiction
so
or...
fun.
Yeah.
Well, I remember one of my books, I needed a contract killer. And I didn't want this guy to be the normal steely-eyed contract killer like you see on television. I ended up being a guy that runs a bar in Tacoma. He's kind of a dumpy, cheerful guy, and he's got a dumpy, cheerful wife. And it was just fun to have that character who would just, as a by-the-way side job, would go out and contract killings. But it wasn't. But it was, again, that was the fun of the thing. It was inventing that kind of a character. So.
Right.
And he's kind of inept, too, which is also fun. But,
well, it is fun to round out the characters and give them surprises to remind the reader that don't suppose you know what someone is on the surface. There's always more going on beneath the surface than would first appear. I think the best fiction does that.
Yeah, and I think also, I mean, I've had people say this before. I know my agent one time said, you know, you have to know the character down to their shoe size. I mean, you don't put all that stuff in the book.
Yeah.
But once you've got it figured out, you know, it just helps you write the story. But, you know, from, and again, I like to switch perspectives with, you know, from chapter to chapter, from character to character. That helps me, you know, get into the mind of the characters as I'm writing the story.
Oh, switching characters helps you stay in their mind, so you know where that you kind of helps you keep touch with them, so you know where they are and what they're doing by switching characters.
Yeah. But one thing, this happened to be down in Tucson at the book festival. I was on a panel with John Sanford down there, and he's always been one of my favorite writers. And I was really surprised when somebody was asking him about the plotting for novels. And his answer was identical to the one I've given. It's like a little engineering problem. I mean, you'll pick a direction to go in the book. And like I've used the example of my third book, which was about the no-fly zone around D.C. And I decided in that book that I was going to have a little plane almost crash into the White House. And that was basically chapter one. I didn't have a clue where I was going after that. And then it's like this little engineering problem. If you're going to crash into a plane into the White House, well, why would you do it? Well, there's only four or five reasons why. So you pick one.
Right.
And then you start to write from that reason. Then you say, well, what would the bad guy do? There's only four or five reasons, so you pick one of those. And it's like a little engineering problem. You're going from one step to the next step based on, I'll go this direction. If that doesn't work out, I'll just back up and try the other direction.
Right. So interesting. All right. Well, listen, we have just a couple minutes left, Mike. I'd like you to answer one more question for me. Finish this sentence. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
Humility.
How has it taught you humility? It's good. That's actually a common answer. And how did it teach you that?
Well, first of all, it teaches you that just because you get a book deal doesn't necessarily mean you're going to rocket to the top of the bestseller list.
That's correct.
And secondly, I think it's one of the things that I don't like about writing, I guess, is because I've always loved to read. And now I find myself, when I'm reading books, you know, sometimes I'll be in this jealousy mode where I'll say, well, how can a piece of crap like this possibly get to the top of the bestseller list? But other times I'll be in a mode where I'll read a book and I'll say, I cannot possibly write as well as this guy. I'll never be able to write as well as him. So in either case, you know, it becomes humility. You learn humility. I mean, it's just but the good news is, as long as you enjoy what you're doing, and I've been very lucky that I've continued to be published, But people, you know, they'll admire what you're doing. They don't understand, I think, that you don't usually feel as good about yourself as they may feel about the books.
That's awesome. Well, Mike, stay humble, okay? I don't think there'll be a problem for you, but as long as you do, it'll make the work a little easier. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, and thank you, Bill. I really appreciate it, and good luck with the memoir you're writing and the classes. They all sound very interesting to me.
Oh, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. Good luck with Rosarito Beach. And did you hear how often Mike used the word enjoy? I really enjoy it. I really enjoy it. You've got to enjoy it. You've got to. That's why we're doing it, because your readers want to enjoy it. You're meant to enjoy your life. You're not meant to just suffer through this experience and not die. You're meant to enjoy it. So by all means, enjoy it. Now, next week, I'm going to be speaking of dying. I'm going to be talking to Douglas Bauer, author of the essay collection Matters of Life and Death, and that should be good. But in the meantime, do what you love, stay humble, talk to people you love, and, I don't think you can go wrong. We'll see you next week. Be humble.